What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Since the attacks of 9/11, even before, Americans have been warned about the rise of religious extremism around the world. And even when extreme religiosity is not linked to terrorism, it's said that religious fervor is globally on the rise. But my guest today, scholar Alan Wolfe, says a striking trend is being ignored, that religion is evolving to accommodate secular life. This hour, On Point, religion around the world and its movement towards peace. Joining me now in the studio is Alan Wolfe, professor of political science and founding director of the Boissy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. He's just written an article about what he describes as the coming religious peace for the March issue of The Atlantic called And the Winner Is. Alan Wolfe, it's great to have you here. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure, Jane.
So you write right off the top in this article that for the last two millennia, humans have fought over most ideas involving the divine. How is that landscape changing globally today?
There's been, of course, a tremendous amount of religious conflict throughout most of our history, especially among the monotheistic religions, which have long competed for turf, religious wars, religious sectarianism. I mean, the history of the West is in many ways the history of religious conflict, and the relationship between the rest and the West of the world is also such a thing. But, you know, so there's a tendency to see that that's going on all the time, and we hear a lot about what's been called the clash of civilizations. Mm-hmm. And just as we've had wars between religions in the past, the wars between religions are going to constitute our future. I don't think that's true. I certainly think it's true of the past, but that's no necessary reason for believing that it's true of the future. And so I try to take on head on, this idea that religious fervor is growing everywhere, and B, that religions are bound to engage in a conflict that's going to result in violent struggle.
Let me read from your article. You say, breathless warnings about rising religious fervor and conflicts ignore two basic facts. First, many areas of the world are experiencing a decline in religious belief and practice. And second, when religions are flourishing, they are also generally evolving, very often in ways that allow them to fit more easily into secular societies and that weaken them as politically disruptive forces. Can you explain those two points?
Okay. Well, the first one's pretty easy in the sense that, you know, there are big parts of the world where religion is all but disappearing. Mm-hmm. And you can't just write them off because they're pretty important parts of the world. Now, the one that everybody talks about first is Western Europe, where religion has been on the decline for a long period of time, where we're really in a post-Christian, a post-religious atmosphere. Still, there are a couple of holdovers. There are countries like Ireland and Spain, where just 50 years ago, the Catholic Church was very powerful. Well, Ireland and Spain are now the two most secular countries in Europe. In Spain, they're more liberal with respect to gay marriage than we are in Massachusetts. And in Ireland, the only people going to church in Ireland these days are Polish immigrants. So, you know, Western Europe, it's really been a decline of religion. Of course, you have got Polish immigrants, so people say, well, Eastern Europe is a bastion of religion. Look at Poland, for example. Mm-hmm. But Poland recently elected a fairly secular president and repudiated a party with very, very close ties to the Catholic Church, whereas other countries in Eastern Europe are not especially religious at all.
Is this because of the rise in prosperity?
It's the rise of
wealth?
Prosperity, the rise of wealth, absolutely. This is one of the most basic ideas in social theory, that with increasing wealth, you get decreasing religiosity. And people like to question it these days, but really it's really true, and you see it in Europe. An even more interesting place where you see it is in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
Which
has been known for its piety.
We hear a lot about the rise of Pentecostalism, you know, but the United States might well elect a woman or an African American as president, but we're never going to elect an atheist as president. Well, Chile elected an atheist as president, a single woman who doesn't believe in God. If you believe that you know, being enlightened means not being religious. Chile is a much more enlightened country than the United States by that measure. Mm. Mexico City has very much liberalized its abortion laws. South Dakota is tightening up its abortion laws. So, you know, Latin America is another area where you've got increasing prosperity and decreasing religion.
You put all of these, you plot all of these points in all of these countries on a fascinating pie graph here in this article. And interestingly, the United States has an interesting spot on that graph.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, the United States is a real outlier. I think it's, along with Kuwait, it's the only other country that, where you have high wealth and high religiosity. In this chart, religiosity was was measured by people's answers to survey questions about how much they believe in God and how often they attend church. So the United States really is an outlier. I mean, look at Canada to our north, a country that has prosperity roughly like us, but decreasing religion on the European pattern. Look at Mexico to our south, but here we are. We have a great deal of wealth and we have a great deal of religiosity. And so that does make us something of an exception. Although I also argue in my piece that there are parts of the world where religion is increasing, definitely, and the United States is one of them. But it's not really a religious revival in the old-fashioned sense of the term.
In what way, then?
Well, our religious revival is very secular. It's very much based upon the idea of freedom to choose. It's very much based on a sort of Adam Smith model of the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
It assumes that the world in which we live is a world in which people exercise freedom and liberty, and then religion follows that, as opposed to the world that we rebelled against in the 18th century, the old regime, the ancien regime of Europe, which was a world in which you were told what your religion was, and then any choice you exercised was within that boundary. We've reversed that. We make choice primary. I understand that there's a new Pew poll coming out which shows that huge majorities in the United States have switched religion. Over the course of their life, they make a choice, intermarriage, all these things, you know. So once you sort of accept secular principles of organizing the world, religion can indeed grow and flourish.
Hmm. Also in the article, you talk, of course, a lot about the rise of Islam. Islam claims a fifth, you say in the article, of the world's population, and its share is climbing quickly. It's only a matter of time, you say, before it surpasses Christianity, which is embraced by a third of the world's population, to become the predominant faith. How will the rise of Islam impact this religious fervor that we've been referring to this hour as its membership increases worldwide?
Well, you know, there's a tendency naturally to believe that because Islam is a religion that, say, unlike Christianity, blends church and state and creates theocratic governments, that the rise of Islam will inevitably be accompanied by conservative religious fervor. And, you know, sure, there's some of that. You see that, for example, in Saudi Arabia, the place where the terrorists who bombed us on September 11th came from. But again, this is a remarkably oversimplified view of the world. We just had yesterday a fascinating election in Pakistan. Mm. And the way it's being played in the press is that, you know, Pervez Musharraf lost the election. But it's the religious parties in Pakistan that suffered an overwhelming defeat. Pakistan, you know, you ask Americans, hey, where's a country where there's a great deal of religious fervor? And they're likely to think Pakistan. Hmm. But in fact, Pakistan is a country where the person who really should be prime minister, except for an assassination, was a Harvard and Oxford educated woman, supported by legions of Western suit-wearing lawyers.
Yes, you said that in the piece. Yes, yes.
India, right next door to Pakistan, is one of the world's most dynamic growing countries. It had a fundamentalist Hindu movement that held power for a while, but it lost an election and hasn't really been able to recover. China, the world's most rapid... Well, now I'm leaving Islam, sorry.
let's stay there for a minute, because the Middle East, of course, this huge area of great concern for many Americans when it comes to this religious expression mixed with this fervor. But you say in the piece that the notion that Islamic fundamentalism will sweep the entire region is simply not realistic. Why?
That's right. Well, you know, even in more traditional Arab countries where Islam has always been strong, such as Egypt, for example, much of the revival of Islam actually sort of resembles a kind of prosperity gospel kind of movement, a self-help kind of movement. We usually don't get that picture. We hear about the terrorists. And we don't hear about the imams who wear jeans and preach to young people and use iPods.
Right. You talk about this evangelist as televangelist from Egypt.
That's right.
Who lives most of the time in England but appeals to young people in ways that you say are neither strictly modern nor strictly fundamentalist.
Yeah. And of course, the fact that he lives in England suggests that a very large number of Muslims now do live in Western Europe. In fact, Islam is the second largest religion in almost every European country. That is, in a country that's predominantly Catholic, there'll be more Muslims than Protestants. And in a country that's predominantly Protestant, there'll be more Muslims than Catholics. So we have a huge presence of Islam. And what we're witnessing, well, some, you know, people on my right say we're witnessing, you know, a Wahhabi takeover of Europe, Eurabia, some scary writers call it. But in fact, what we're witnessing in Europe is Muslims adjusting to the laws of liberal democracy and accommodating their religion to liberal principles. And I think it's a very positive development.
So why do you think, Professor Wolf, that there is this perception of this religious fervor extremism? Is it just that there are groups that are that way and they get most of the attention? Or what is it?
Yeah, I think to a large part it has to do with an interesting story. My piece in The Atlantic was really inspired by a whole issue that the British magazine The Economist ran a few months back, where it, you know, put down all these ideas about this religious fervor taking over the world. It makes great copy. And that issue of The Economist got a lot of attention. I'm not a great fan of The Economist. I think they're often a purveyor of wisdom that's just about to be negated. But, you know, that's what sells.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about religion's secularization around the world. My guest today is Alan Wolfe, director of the Boissy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. Professor, what role does modernity play in the modern religious practice?
Well, there is such a thing as modernity. I don't think we're in a postmodern world, and we're certainly no longer in a premodern one. I mean, modernity for me means, generally speaking, the principles of the Enlightenment, the principles of liberal democracy, the idea that we have liberty and that we can exercise liberty. I'm always struck by this sense that modernity means a kind of sense of doom that you get from so many people. Because to me, the modern world is an extraordinary thing. The idea that we shape our own lives, that we're the captains of our souls, that we're in command of the kind of lives that we're going to live. This, to me, is one of the most powerful ideas in human history. That's what is so important. And it's really modernity that spreads everywhere rather than religion. Because once people experience that notion, boy, it's really hard. You know, there's a popular song from the 1920s, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? I mean, how are you going to keep them down on the
right,
farm?
Right, Is that what this, when you refer to as the free religious marketplace?
Yeah, that's,
is that what you're talking
about? That's the kind of thing
about?
I'm talking about. Yeah. The idea that we human beings are not and don't have to be subject to forces outside of our control, that there's not some fate that writes in a book somewhere the course of our lives, and then we just lived out a script written by some higher authority. What's so striking about so much of religion today is that we do become, through religion, the authors of our fate. We take our fate into our own hands. Everything is not written. Everything is not predetermined.
So is religion becoming less divisive to your mind?
I would put it this way. There's certainly a great deal of religious conflict remaining in the world, and people who care about their faith care about it to the extent of, wanting to make sure that it triumphs. And there still are religious wars, although nothing like the ones we've had in the past. But so many of our contemporary religions want to grow. They want to find new members. And you don't find new members by killing them. As long as there is this priority on conversion, the only way that you can convert somebody is to appeal to their individual need. And that, I think, operates as a hidden but very, very powerful incentive against violence.
What about in the United States, the divisive nature of religion? Do you think it's getting better or worse? If you just look back to the presidential election, yeah, even, and you see religion inserted into that.
Right. We certainly have had religion inserted into our politics the last 20 or 30 years, but clearly we're getting over it. I mean, it doesn't matter who the Democratic nominee will be. McCain versus either Clinton or Obama will not be an election heavily shaped by abortion and stem cells. The issues in this election are going to be Iraq and the recession that seems to be looming. We're going to go back to old-fashioned politics where people don't actually get up and say, hey, you know, I went to church on Sunday, or God told me to invade another country, or anything like that.
But don't you think that that's still important to a lot of people, to a lot of Americans?
It's certainly important to people, but even the most religious people in America, and by them I mean the evangelical,
yes,
Christians, who are the people who generally sort of injected religion and politics, the single biggest movement now among evangelicals in America is the recognition that religion was corrupted by blending with politics. And there is a huge spiritual yearning on the part of many evangelicals to purify their faith, which means getting it out of the realm of elections and really making it something through which people can grow. I mean, this book by Rick Warren, The Purpose-Driven Life,
yes,
25 million, whatever, billion copies, whatever it is. You know, the whole idea of a purpose-driven life, that we live for purpose. That Rick Warren begins his book by saying, it's not about you. Well, it is about you. And everybody who reads the book knows.
You talk about that book, actually, in your piece. You say it sells well in Africa, of all places.
You know, the African revival, I mean, here we're, yeah, jumping from the U.S. to Africa, is about people becoming interested in the prosperity gospel. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most, you know, my friends on the left generally tend to be very secular and against globalization. There's a contradiction there. If you want to see a more secular world, you should support globalization. Globalization has been good for secularism, where capitalism and the market triumphs. Old-fashioned religion does not.
Professor Wolf, let me bring another voice into our conversation now. From Chicago is Martin Marty, Professor Emeritus of Religion at the University of Chicago. He's a preeminent scholar of religion and culture and the author of more than 50 books, including his latest book, The Christian World, A Global History. Martin Marty, thank you so much for joining us, Professor.
Hi, good to be with you.
So is increasing secularism a fair price for the religious peace of which Alan Wolf speaks about?
Well, I think he's dead on in his description of what goes on. It may be a little confusing if he and I are too ready to use the word secularism, because when you attach the word ISM to anything, people think it's a thought-out creed, communism, socialism, and so on. Whereas it's a complex of things, which I think he describes quite accurately. I fumble around looking for a different word, and I can't find anything. In the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, I've been touting a word called religio-secular, which is hardly hit parade among new coinages. But what I'm trying to get at is that the things we used to associate with secular, worldly, and more preoccupied with the material,
yeah,
et cetera, and what we used to think of as religion, namely apart from it, are so knotted up, and I think he describes that well, that something new is going on out there.
How have American churches, Professor Marty, changed and adapted, if you will, in recent years, in recent decades?
Well, I think maybe the biggest shift is the one to which Alan Wolf just pointed when he said the most religious people in America are the evangelicals. I'm not sure I want to go along with that. There are a lot of mystics out there and monks and retreatants and all kinds of high church Episcopalians who are very religious, but I know what he means and you know what he means. They're the ones that cultural indicators keep watching. Now, there has been huge change among them in the last decades. Around 1930, the great theologian H. Richard Niebuhr, brother Reinhold Niebuhr, wrote a book on the social sources of denominationalism. And when he got to the people that today we call fundamentalists, Pentecostals, evangelicals, etc., he called them the disinherited. They're the outsiders. We thought of them as backwoods. They were hillbillies, holy rollers, up in the hills of Tennessee or the plains of Texas. And we turn around again, and now they're driving Jaguars and building $100 million churches, et cetera.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's quite a shift to be moved mm-hmm. from the disinherited to making a big part of your goal how to inherit.
Would you say that the way they practice the religion then is more intense? Is there an intensity of the religious practice?
So I wouldn't say more intense. That is, if you've ever been up where the snake handlers were in Tennessee, or if you've ever been to a real revival, That's intensity. They blow the rooftop of the church off almost. But as individual organizing of life is concerned, I think there's a good deal of intensity there. It's hard to judge. You almost have to take it case by case.
What about more broadly speaking, just across the American religious spectrum?
I can't call it intense. I can call it devoted. I can call it a hunger for fulfillment, and so on. But I on occasion go to youth, evangelical youth kinds of gatherings, and when the drums are going and the beat is on and all the guitars are at it and they're jumping up and down, you'd think you are where there's real intensity, and then you go out after a while and shoot baskets and go to the mall and so on, and they want the same things everybody else does, and you almost forget what they were about.
How deep, Professor Marty, would you say Americans' understanding of their own religion is?
Again, it's hard to generalize, but because there are just enormous counterexamples. That is, there are denomination-wide and congregation-wide study groups with many different names in which very devoted people show up on Wednesday night or Sunday mid-morning and work at it. But overall, if you take the census people, a lot of people believe the Bible is inerrant, you shouldn't change a word of it, and it all matters, and they can't name the four Gospels or the Ten Commandments. There's a great vast pools of ignorance there. So you can't say there it prevails. And I'm a church historian. I have to say that many of the things that we consider real landmarks in Christian history are pretty well forgotten. Many of the churches that Alan Wolfe, I think, describes quite successfully almost deliberately trash the past. You have the prophets, you have Jesus, and then nothing good happens until this Sunday. You don't even save last Sunday's church bulletins or hymns. You trash them, and it all has to be new. Well, you can't do that and be aware of the Christian past. And I think that if you dip your measuring stick into a little Iowa Methodist church in the 1840s or a Boston Catholic church in the 1920s, you'd find they knew more of what's in the creeds. They know more of parts of the Bible.
Than we do now.
Oh. Yeah.
Let's go to the phones for a moment here and invite some callers in. Virginia Beach, Virginia, is where Paul is. Paul, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you.
I've got a question. Historically, it seems that the more democratizing forces like technology and evolved political philosophy have helped Christianity come a long way. For example, 500 years ago, you had very, very draconian practices of people that were being punished for, breaking religious laws, but not necessarily laws against humanity, like, you know, for example, adultery, sort of victimless crime sort of stuff. But nowadays, you've got a little bit more moderated version of that, even though people still say that they, they don't believe in evolution. Christianity does not directly affect their lives so much as Islam does. But because Islam is a newer religion, how long do you think it will take for things like technology and democracy and, you know, the pressure of the rest of the world, either intellectually or philosophically or, you know, to a certain part militarily, how long do you think it will take Islam to become, I guess, the level of secularity, even if that's
modernism.
A word?
Yeah. Paul, good question. Thanks so much for calling. Professor Wolf?
Well, there's no necessary reason why one religion should follow the historical path that other religions followed. And, you know, implicit in the question is sort of the idea that Christianity has achieved a certain goal, and when will Islam achieve that same goal? I don't think it'll achieve that same goal in the same way. Religions are different. But we are, as I mentioned in the Atlantic piece, you know, we're already witnessing major transformations in Islam. For one thing, most Muslims throughout most of the course of our history lived in Muslim-majority societies. That's breaking down. So Muslims living abroad in the United States, for example, have to practice their religion in a very, very different way. But I think the biggest impact is what we were talking about just before, and that's the globalization. Mm-hmm. Even when people don't leave their countries but remain, the world enters into a country in a way that's so totally different from what Islam might have been like in the 9th century or the 10th century or the 11th century. No one can really escape globalization, and that will have a huge impact. How long it'll take? Sorry, I'm not a prophet.
Mm-hmm. Professor Marty, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah. I like Paul's question, but I think I wouldn't use the word technology so much as I would a word like the Enlightenment. That is, faiths have amazing ways adapting to the technical world. I once spoke in a, I would call it almost fundamentalist church in Dallas, where the pulpit, I've never seen anything like it in anywhere else. You could tell, I could change the temperature, I could change the heat, I could change the volume. I could say there's a baby crying in nursery 3C in a parking light, all that stuff. And I stuck around, this was between services, I stuck around and the minister preached against technology. In other words, the fundamentalists, Pentecostals, evangelicals, are by far the masters of the Internet. Mainline Protestants and Catholics fumble around. We never caught on how to use television, etc. So I don't think technology kills it off. I think the change came for the West in, quote, the Enlightenment, and where that reaches Islam, we see a change. The founders of the nation in the 1780s and so on, who had a very different concept. They were not unreligious or irreligious, but they transformed religion, and they opened the door for the old-time religions to break through. Thomas Jefferson couldn't have gotten what we call separation of church and state if it weren't for some Baptist hillbillies like Elder John Leland. Both adapted. And I think what we're seeing in the Islamic world, not enough of that has happened. If you could dip back 7 or 8 centuries, they were ahead of the West in a lot of technology, and then bad stuff happened. Mm.
Martin Marty, Professor Emeritus of Religion at the University of Chicago, thank you so much for your time and your perspective today, sir. I appreciate it very much.
Good to be conversing with Alan, even though we didn't get to converse with each other.
Thank you again. Professor Wolf, is faith prolonging some of the world's conflicts today?
There certainly have been certain parts of the world where we've been led to believe that faith is at the heart of a number of our conflicts. The Middle East, you know, primarily. I mean, what we have in the Middle East are 3 monotheistic religions, all having a presence in a way that's bound to fuel controversy in places like Jerusalem. But even if you look, you know, at that one, even if you examine what's really happening, say, in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it strikes me that religion, while overwhelmingly important, obviously, because it's a conflict between different religions, that it's also a conflict over land. It's also a conflict over more traditional geopolitical realities about states and how they're formed and who gets to control them. So it's always a question of what's driving what. And I see religion playing a role in a number of conflicts. I don't see it as necessarily driving many of those conflicts. Other things, wars are usually fought for reasons that have to do with geopolitics and with economics and not with religion.
In the piece, you say that religious peace will be the single most important consequence of the secular underpinning of today's religious growth. Before we go to break, briefly explain
that. Yeah, no, Marty made a very good point, and that is I should have realized that, you know, people hear the word secular and they think you mean non-religious. Mm-hmm. But secular is not the opposite of religion. Not religious is the opposite of religion. Secularism is a way of doing religion. It's a way of doing religion based upon the idea of separating religion and politics and recognizing that individuals choose their God. It has religious origins. It has specifically Christian origins. But understood in that way, secularism offers a prospect for toleration that any person examining the alternative between religious peace and religious war will, if they have a choice, choose peace. The problem is sometimes people don't have a choice, and that's when you get war.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about religious wars and religious peace around the world. My guest today is Alan Wolf, director of the Boissy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. Professor, I'm curious what effect globalization has on religion here in this country and around the world.
Around the world, I think it's a subject that we don't know enough about. There's a tendency to think that globalization must be a bad thing because people get exploited. After all, it's big, huge multinational companies, and they want to, you know, get the cheapest labor they can, and they create sweatshops and all these things. I'm no economist, and I'm not prepared to make a judgment on the economic consequences of globalization. But on the religious consequences, I do think we fail to recognize that globalization breaks up old-fashioned religion. It breaks up the ways in which people used to live, the traditional kind of societies, traditional gender relations, traditional shamans or imams or magicians or whoever they are, and it brings people in touch with the wider world. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it contributes to the process of secularization, mm-hmm. or the process I'm calling secularization. Mm-hmm.
With that as a backdrop, I'd like to bring in another voice to our conversation. Joining us now from the University of Notre Dame in Indiana is Daniel Philpott, Associate Professor of Political Science and a Faculty Fellow of the Joan B. Kroc Institute of International Peace Studies. Welcome to you, Professor Philpott.
Hi, Jane.
Nice to have you with us. Thank you. What do you think is the effect of globalization on religion around the world?
Well, I've read Alan's article with great interest, and I can't help but hearing in it a little bit of what has long been called the secularization thesis, which has been very dominant among Western intellectuals over the last 250 years or so. And the claim is really that as globalization proceeds apace, economic growth, technological growth, democratization, and so forth, that religion will gradually decline, or as Alan says, it will take new forms that sort of accommodate themselves to secularism. But I think that the picture is, in fact, much more complex, that, in fact, globalization and secularism are, in fact, encouraging of many different kinds of religious expressions, both peaceful and tolerant and democratic and peace-building, as well as violence and terrorism and civil wars and so forth. And what I would emphasize is that all of these different forms of religious expression, in fact, feed off of and are incubated by, or not only accommodate themselves to, but are very encouraged by and adaptive to modernization and globalization.
So do you see the advance of religion then, I hope I'm understanding you correctly, dampening fanaticism?
The advance of globalization, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily. In some places, globalization has produced the kind of accommodations of religion to freedom and democracy and technology that Alan speaks of. There's certainly truth to that. But in other cases, religious fanaticism and violence and intolerant forms of nationalism not only do just fine, but seem to actually be encouraged by modern conditions like economic growth and democratization and so forth. An example would be one that Alan himself brought up, which would be a Hindu nationalism in India. For decades, India was ruled by the Congress Party, which made secularization a key plank of its rule. And as India grew economically very rapidly, everybody thought that that was the direction it was going. Well, it was an utter shock and surprise when in the 1990s there was a massive, dramatic rise of Hindu nationalism. They even had the Prime Minister's office between 1998 and 2004. And in fact, today, Hindu nationalism remains very strong in India, including in some of the most economically prosperous and advanced parts of India.
I want to go to the phones to join some, have some listeners join us. Ahmed is now calling from Montreal, Canada.
Yes, hi, Jane.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you. I just want to mention, I think secularism has become a new religion in itself, as opposed to the other religions. And if we look at the past 100 years, we can see secularism causing a lot of wars, economic wars, bloodshed in Iraq. If the Bush administration went in Iraq, he didn't go for religious reasons, he went for secular reasons. We have 1 million deaths right now. So I'm just wondering about that. Isn't secularism the new religion?
Professor Philpott?
I think it's a profoundly true point. I do want to take Alan's point that secularism can mean different things. But if for a moment we take secularism to mean the denial of God or an ideology that excludes God, in fact, secularism has been responsible for the massive preponderance of the large-scale violence in the 20th century. And I think the example of Sodom is excellent, that, you know, many people somehow think that this was a kind of form of Islamic fanaticism, but in fact, Sodom was deeply secular and helped to produce tensions in Iraq by his attempt to tamp down religious forces.
Hmm. Rod is on the phone now from Norwich, Connecticut. Rod, hi, welcome.
Thank you. My Bible tells me that what's coming ahead has nothing to do with a golden age of religion and everything to do with one world religion. I'll take my answer off the air.
Rod, thank you. Professor Wolf.
Well, I sure don't see one more religion emerging. I see a situation that as you get more of a global world, you get more pluralism, the way we understand that domestically. Because if the world becomes sort of one world, then it is composed of many different religions. And in a global environment, those religions, well, yeah, they do have the option of trying to exterminate each other. And there certainly is some of that. But they also are going to have to learn how to live together. So we're going to have some kind of version of global pluralism, not unlike the pluralism we've had in the United States domestically.
Professor Philpott?
Well, I also do not see one world religion emerging. I think we have to distinguish between what we hope for and what we see in terms of the global trends. And again, I think we see some trends among religious towards the democratic and the modern and so forth. But I think the last 30 years have also shown us to have the rise of Islamic fanaticism and Hindu nationalism and Buddhist nationalism in Sri Lanka, and in fact what might be called fanaticism in many parts of the world. So it's a mixed picture today, just like it's been a mixed picture in the past.
To Providence, Rhode Island now, where Mary is calling. Hi, Mary. Welcome.
Hi. I'm glad you actually brought up the Buddhist nationalism question, because my question involves the rise of China and how you know, decades of suppression of Buddhism in China may give way to more democratization and thus more ability for people to practice Buddhism. And if you see that impacting, you know, how you see that impacting this whole scenario that you've been sketching out of globalization, especially since Buddhism is such a very different religion than it's a non-theistic religion, and so it forms itself on quite a different premise than the monotheistic religion.
Mary,
so
thanks.
I kind of want to see what you think about Buddhism in China.
Thank you. Professor Wolf?
Yeah, if I could, I mean, I really appreciate Dan Philpott's insights here and value greatly what he's adding to the discussion. I just wanted to say that when we talk about terms like Buddhist nationalism or Hindu nationalism, we're talking as much about nationalism as about religion, and nothing in my analysis or article suggests that nationalism will be decreasing. Nationalism is still a force for violence. When it becomes combined with religion, it's hard to sort out what's the nationalism and what's the religion. On the question of China, I mean, China is, of course, when every discussion, whether you're talking economics, politics, or religion, China is so huge. And we just don't know what's going to happen with respect to China. But it just seems to me that in terms of what we call the secularization thesis, that as countries become more wealthy, you get a decline in old-fashioned forms of religion, that China will conform to that. We don't know what kind of pattern that's going to take. Maybe it will take, with greater individual freedom, you'll get more people sort of choosing their religion and choosing older forms of Buddhism. Mm. Just hard to say at this point.
What about religion and politics, Professor Philpott? In crafting its foreign policy, how does the U.S. account for religion? How should it?
Well, in my view, U.S. foreign policy has long been too much under the influence of the secularization thesis, not understanding the importance of religion in the world. And to the degree that it does think religion is important, it largely sees it as a kind of irrational force, something to be opposed and something to be contained. But again, I think I would like to see policymakers come to have a greater understanding of the diversity of religious expression, and then to see ways in which the United States can actually find allies in religious parties who could potentially be promoters of democratization and peace and modernity and so forth. I think we've too often made alliances with, going back to the caller's point about secularism, with deeply secular rulers like Mubarak in Egypt and others who have, in fact, suppressed religion, whereas I think in many societies like this, Arab countries, by making more room for the expression of Islam, we can actually see a greater chance for a democratic Islam to emerge.
Hmm. What about that, Professor Wolf? Politics and U.S. policy?
I hope he's right. I mean, we have sometimes work with religious parties. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, we worked very closely with Christian democratic parties in Europe to form an alliance against communism, and that was a kind of recognition, and we were supporting religious parties. So that might be an exception to the generalization. But look, when we talk about Third World, we're talking about some pretty serious problems. Saddam Hussein was indeed a secular ruler who was brutal and horrendous, but deposing him and unleashing Shia versus Sunni hostility has also got its problems. I generally agree, though, with Dan Philpott. I think we need to be far more sensitive to these religious movements, in part because we have to trust that they will accommodate themselves to the values, the secular values that we embody.
To Needham, Massachusetts now. And Dennis, who is calling, welcome to On Point. Dennis, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to follow up on some of the secularization discussion.
Sure.
My understanding of Islam is that to be a practicing Muslim, you need to pray five times a day, preferably in a mosque, whereas to be a practicing Jew, you can go to temple on Saturday, and or a Christian, go to church on Sunday. If, in fact, those religious practice, the demands of Islam are make it so much more central to people's lives, wouldn't that indicate that secularization would be a very difficult kind of cultural choice for the Islamic world to make?
Professor Philpott, your response to Dennis's question.
I think Dennis makes a very good point. It's important to see how in Islam, like Christianity, people today, we see in the United States and in the Islamic world, we see a great number of very devout religious believers, and not necessarily any diminishment of devout religious believers. But what I would go on to say is that I think we need to understand that it is very possible in many parts of the world that out of the very devotion and out of the very fervency of religious belief, people can turn to encouraging things like democracy and tolerance and peace building every much as they can towards religious violence. And I think we see this in Islam. We see in Turkey is a fascinating example where devout religious believers, and in fact Turkey has been under the rule of an Islamic party, democratic rule, since 2002, where very devout religious believers who are only now calling for lifting the ban on headscarves in universities are also the same people supporting democracy. So that's the possibility that I want to underline, the possibility of not being the captain of one soul, but obedient to God, and out of that, a very obedience to God, also supporting democracy and human rights and that sort of thing. Mm.
Last question before we end this hour is Eileen, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Once I heard the word materialism crop up in the comments, and I'm thinking that we need to couple that with secularism, and certainly from the standpoint of American megachurches who are also, energetically preaching the prosperity message, that we as a very wealthy nation, 4 or 5% of the world population using 30% of the world's energy, are somehow feeling justified and blessed by God that we are where we are.
Eileen, thank you.
And we're doing it on the backs of a lot of poor people, and I want to know how we pull all that together.
I appreciate your call. Professor Wolf, can you couple secularism with materialism?
Well, some of the prosperity-oriented kinds of churches, or at least the churches that have very prosperous members in the evangelical world, like Rick Warren's Saddleback Church in California, there may be some members there that are sort of attracted to the idea that America is a special providential place blessed by God. On the other hand, Rick Warren's doing fantastic work in Africa fighting AIDS. Some of it has a missionary side to it, but it's actually not really the major reason. There is a genuine sense emerging among many evangelicals that being blessed with all this prosperity, we have an obligation to share it and to do something for poverty in the world. That's a hugely important movement.
Last question to both of you as we wrap up this hour. Do you envision a long-lasting religious peace, as Professor Wolf states in his article? Professor Daniel Philpott, we respond to that first?
Well, I don't. I think the possibility of religious violence in modernity is still ever-present, and I don't see any reason for it to abate. We might see some kind of temporary declines in it, but I think there's no reason not to expect it to return and even to be motivated by religion. But I also will think we'll see a different valence as well, where even in economically prosperous capitalist modern societies, people will continue to believe religion in a very deep-felt way, where they're primarily seeing themselves as, guided by God, and will out of that will produce very fervent expressions of support for democracy and human rights and reconciliation and peace building and that sort of thing. So I think we'll continue to see this these diverse valences.
What do you think, Alan Wolf? Last word.
Well, I think, to some degree, some of those who prophesize the clash of civilizations or an emerging religious war, I mean, I won't say there's a kind of glee behind it. I'm not talking about Daniel Philpott or Martin Marty or anyone on this program. But, you know, there's almost like a glee, almost like, hey, you know, we Westerners have a sense of hubris. We take pride in our values of freedom, and we're going to be punished for that because we fail to recognize how intensely fervid people in the rest of the world are, and this ultimate Armageddon or this ultimate conflict is going to come about. I don't really see that. I the gains of modernity are just enormously powerful and attractive. And just as President Bush believes that everyone could be susceptible to the ideas of democracy, I believe that everyone can be susceptible to the ideas of individual choice and individual freedom. I think the world is moving toward a place where we can learn to live with one another. And I see no reason to prophesize the doom and gloom. That can only perhaps bring it about. And I would rather bring about a better world than that.
Thank you to all my guests today. From Notre Dame, Indiana, Professor Daniel Philpott, Associate Professor of Political Science.
Thank you, Jane.
Faculty Fellow at the Joan D. Kroc Institute of International Peace. Thanks so much, Professor. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
And Professor Alan Wolf, here in our studio, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Boissy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. His piece in The Atlantic this month is called "And the Winner Is." Thanks, Professor.
Always a pleasure to struggle with Notre Dame.
Thank you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.